Hey, are you hungry? Well, you're in luck. Meat and Three is back for season 16. I'm Taylor Early, and we've got a whole new batch of reporters I am so excited to introduce you to.
Hi, I'm Elizabeth Fisher.
Asha McElroy.
Sam Girardi.
Jessica Gingrich.
Hannah from Wisconsin.
I'm a swing dancing audio engineer.
I am a future registered dietitian nutritionist.
I'm from New York, and I love rice and beans.
My favorite food of all time is a shrimp burrito.
I love watermelon.
We've also got a bonus podcast for you called Behind the Internship. Three of our reporters will take you along to show how they develop stories for this very show, Meat and Three.
Hi, I'm Danielle Flitter, a plant-based chef from Philadelphia, living in Mexico City.
I'm Sophia Hooper. I'm a bartender based in Portland, Maine.
My name is Addison Austin Liu. I am a chef and food journalist from Salt Lake City, Utah, and my favorite food is Peruvian.
Rice and beans.
Hand-drawn noodle soup.
So tune in to enjoy a square meal for your ears. And I hope you saved a little room for dessert.
This episode has been brought to you by Sake Man, a group of sake superheroes bringing sake to the world. This week on Meat and Three, we get ready for Super Tuesday by looking at how food shapes elections, both at home and abroad.
People know that you don't order a Philly cheesesteak with Swiss cheese, as John Kerry did back in the 2004 cycle.
A young group of friends decided that they would put up a website which told voters which polling booths had sausages.
Prime Minister David Cameron was pictured about a week after this incident eating a hot dog in a bun with a knife and fork because he was so afraid.
Tune in to Meat and Three, HRN's weekly food news roundup, wherever you listen to podcasts.
Good evening, and welcome to Eating Matters, where we talk about food systems and policy and how they impact all of us. I'm your host, Jenna Liute, and we're broadcasting from Roberta's on Heritage Radio Network. Today, I want to broaden the scope of the waste series that I've been doing to include a closer look at the waste management and recycling industries writ large. Certainly, there are major overlaps with organics, especially since food is the largest single source, the largest solid material in landfills, and food packaging is the biggest user of single-use plastics, which of course don't get recycled. But what exactly happens to something when you throw it out? Where does it go and how is it processed? And what are some of the major issues facing the waste management industry today? Joining me to discuss is Ev Crunden. Ev is a waste management and recycling reporter with Waste Dive, and Ev has a background in reporting on climate and environmental issues. Ev, welcome to the show.
Hi, Jenna. How are you?
Great. Okay, so before we get started, I was listening to that preview, and I was wondering what the deal. I don't know if you remember this, but what's wrong with ordering Swiss cheese on a Philly cheesesteak? What John Kerry did. Is that elitist? Did I miss that?
I have no idea. But I mean, as a vegetarian, I could give you my input.
That's okay. Good point. Okay. Sorry. That just struck me as funny. I'm like, I totally missed that criticism of Kerry in 2000, whatever, four.
Talk about dairy emissions, I guess.
Yeah. Okay. So let's get started on the real topic. Tell me first and foremost why you decided to start to cover the most sexy beat in the world.
The sexiest beat in the world.
Yeah. Waste management.
Yeah. You know, it's a funny one, and you don't meet waste reporters very often. I got into environmental reporting and was really focusing on climate change for several years, and, you know, it comes up a lot, not as often as it should, I think, but it does come up in climate reporting, you know, emissions associated with landfills specifically, sometimes with incineration, and, you know, I was always just really interested, and, you know, I've pivoted now to it's sort of the reverse, where now I cover waste all the time, but, you know, with a climate emphasis, as opposed to climate all the time with a bit of a wasteland So, you know, just was on my way in there.
There you go. There you go. All right, Ev, let's get a lay of the land. Who are the big stakeholders in the waste management industry? I mean, like how is it managed? Can you kind of talk about the difference between like the federal government, the local government, commercial, residential, private companies, processing facilities? Help us like get a grasp on what this looks like.
Yeah. So, I mean, everyone you've named is part of this very large complex system. You know, we have, it's really, the federal government has really kicked it to municipalities. So part of what makes U.S. waste so fun is that it's really on a municipality by municipality basis. So, you know, you may have gone from one area to another and thought, you know, something that was recyclable now is not. That's because you're correct. It's completely changed. You know, it's really a mix of, I hesitate to use the word monopoly, but there are a handful of very large companies that mm-hmm. really rule waste. So number one is Waste Management. You've mm-hmm. probably seen their trucks, their logo.
Yeah.
They're the big guys. Republic, number two, they're also big. You've probably also seen them. Waste Connections is also up there. And those are kind of the holy trinity. Lots of smaller players, depending on your area. Some are big in different regions. But you have these, you know, it's a handful of companies, and typically they operate through a lot of contracts with local governments. Sometimes you have, you know, one company that will have, you know, a big hold in your area. Sometimes, you know, I live in Washington, D.C. You'll see Waste Management, you'll see Republic, you'll see them all.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, it really depends. And typically, you know, the big waste companies are also responsible for recycling.
Oh.
You do see some recycling companies that are kind of separate, but for the most part, really like a monopoly on the whole waste stream. And, you know, they really deal with your government. And then you get kind of a mix depending on where you live. Curbside, pretty common in a lot of cities. You know, you put it outside and then someone takes it on one day of the week.
Mm-hmm.
And it, you never think about it again.
Right. That's why we're talking about it today.
Yeah. You should be thinking about it, but you know, one imagines you probably aren't. And then, you know, sometimes for things like recycling, again, you know, more of a drop-off system where you might be going to like a local, you know, drop-off center, essentially.
So, okay. So these main three players, operates just so, make sure that I understand, mostly on the like municipality level. And so these big companies will partner or will contract with, like have these giant contracts with the city. And then what do they do? Do they handle everything? Like pick up what is the breadth of these contracts typically?
Yeah. So again, it depends, which is going to be like the magic response of anything involving waste. But yeah, you know, typically your contract with the city could involve lots of things. Sometimes the city likes to handle certain components of it. Sometimes they've just kicked the whole thing to like State Republic.
Mm-hmm.
But you know, pretty typically, you put out, you know, your trash, and then Republic, say in this scenario, you know, has you know, a truck, and they'll drive up and they'll take it. A lot of times, then it will go to a transfer station.
Mm-hmm.
That's like kind of a smaller midway facility. Then they're going to grind down your trash and kind of like package it up. And then it's going to go to a bigger hauler, like a bigger truck. And then it could be carted any number of places, sometimes like states and states away, depending on where you live. So it can be a very involved, very, very long-term process.
And it's carted to landfills, I'm assuming?
Typically landfills, yeah. You know, in a few cases, you're looking at incineration, but that's, in the U.S., significantly less common. You're usually looking at landfills.
Okay, so landfills are something that, like, I feel like we all kind of have an idea of what these look like, just, like, giant trash heaps. But what is, like, have you ever toured a landfill? I'm assuming that's kind of been part of something you've done.
Yeah, I have seen a landfill. They, you know, typically, and if you've actually might even have driven past one. When I was younger, you know, I grew up in Texas in Austin, and we have a landfill that I used to drive past and think it looked so much fun to play on. And you know, understandably, was disavowed of that notion by my mother. But you know, you're typically looking at like they're pretty big. feel like the average is about 600 acres. So you want like a pretty big chunk of land. For, you know, the interests of community relations, you probably want it to be a little bit further away from people, mm-hmm. as far away as you can, just because, as you'll know, if you've been to a landfill, they don't smell wonderful. Mm-hmm. So you typically, for the value of your property, you don't want to be around one. But essentially, this sounds so crass, but it's kind of a giant hole in the ground. Mm-hmm. And what you're doing is you're dumping your trash, basically. But at this rate in U.S. waste policy, we do have liner systems in place for virtually all landfills. So that's typically like a clay and then high density plastic. So you have these layers, basically, because you're trying to keep it from seeping into the ground.
Okay.
So you're layering the trash, like kind of in these segments. Mm-hmm. And typically, you have to cover it, a little layer of dirt, at the end of the day, keep the smells from getting out. And then in regions where, say you have rain or snow, you've got this beautiful thing, the beautiful word called leach it, which
okay.
is the beautiful wastewater thing that emerges. And then typically you have, systems in place for draining the leach it, sending it to a wastewater treatment plant, say.
Mm-hmm.
You gotta deal with all that.
All that stuff.
Content. Yeah.
Okay.
all the fun, beautiful things.
So it's like line typically, and then kind of layered like garbage dirt. And then they just bury it. So are these giant pieces of land typically like owned by like government owned or privately owned?
That's another one where there's a mix.
Yeah.
So, you do see situations in which, the government owns it and they just contract out. You see a few where, again, our favorite players, Waste Management, Republic, Waste Connections, mm-hmm. all those guys, where they own it. So, it really, really mix.
Okay. And then where are these typically, are landfills, and I promise to my listeners, we can move on in a minute, but I'm just so fascinated because, because I do not drive by with Fresh Kills closing, having closed. Well, maybe I think it's still operational a little bit, but maybe not at the scale it used to be. But I don't drive by landfills very often, so it's or maybe I do and I don't realize it. Actually, I mean, are they? They're typically like covered with grass, right? Or like.
Yeah, you'd see like hills usually. I think the main indicator you're driving by a landfill is you're seeing like what might be beautiful nature, but there's like intense amounts of security. So
okay,
you see like a big wall. That would be a sign.
All right, that's a good tip.
they're all over the country. You can find them in most places. There are, I think, a little over 3,000 active in the country right now. What is interesting is, there are definitely lots of controversy around landfills. Smells, communities don't like them. Mm-hmm. And so in regions like the Northeast, you see dwindling capacity. And, in addition to saying, oh, you can't build new sites, they're also saying, oh, you can't expand. So that basically means, if you're in the Northeast, you're either losing your landfill capacity and or it's being, sent to other states. The South takes a lot in municipal solid waste. You've got states like Alabama, big landfill capital.
Mm-hmm.
And then, out West is becoming more and more common. And that's also, a drier climate in a lot of areas. And then you're not dealing with leach it. So.
Yeah. And states, I'm assuming, get paid to take this.
Not on a state level per se, but for host fees are pretty common. Areas got to get paid, and that I think when these companies argue that they're actually doing a public good, a lot of times they are actually paying a lot of money to these areas to take this waste.
Yeah, as they should, because who wants to live around a garbage dump?
Exactly.
Okay, so. I would imagine there was 3,000 doesn't seem like as many to me, but you just said active.
It's
so
not. Yeah. There are many more. I would say probably maybe I don't want to just throw numbers out there. I feel maybe more like 10,000 clothes, perhaps.
Like ever, that have ever existed. And yeah. They're just full
all the,
now?
All of your garbage just yeah. sitting there, capped. Capped and being treated.
Does it break down? And it doesn't break down at all under once it's buried? It just stays there forever?
Yeah, it depends. It depends on what's in the landfill. Obviously, organics are going to be breaking down.
Right.
They're going to become methane, hence yeah. our fun little climate tie-in.
Yeah.
You know, you have debates about, like, how long it takes plastic to break down.
Forever,
I've seen, like, 500 years. Definitely that's still sitting there.
Yeah.
But really depends.
Okay, so what are some of the biggest, criticisms or issues with landfill, especially from an environmental concern? You mentioned methane, of course, from when organics break down, and the leaching of, or was it leach it? So that's just contamination of the groundwater?
Yeah, so it's a mix. And to be fair, to a lot of these companies and these sites, there are a lot of protections in place. But that having been said, you know, the methane is kind of hard to avoid. You know, organics decompose. They do release warming gases. Some, you know, operators have landfill gas systems in place that are collecting it. But even then, you know, still only so much you can mitigate that problem. And there are other concerns. I mean, in terms of odors, odors are unpleasant, but they also typically are a sign that there are, like, chemicals and other problems. So for a lot of communities, you know, and it's definitely disproportionately lower-income communities, communities of color, so those tend to be the people who are very close to landfills. And, you know, I've definitely talked to people who, you know, report health problems, dizziness, you know, their animals get sick, their kids get sick. So there are some legitimate concerns, and I think a lot of it, you know, really boils down to whether or not a company is doing their due diligence. But even if they are, you know, hard to be 100% in the clear.
Mm-hmm. So what are the, you've been writing a lot about PFAS. Is PFAS.
PFAS, yeah.
Yes. What are these and why are they an issue?
These are fun. So PFAS, which have a longer name, it's an acronym, but they're a family of more than 5,000 chemical substances. And they are getting a lot of traction. There's a documentary that came out about them, and then a Mark Ruffalo movie called Dark Waters, really scared a lot of people. And with a lot of reason, you know, several of them have been pretty definitively linked to cancer and a number of other very bad health risks. And the thing about PFAS, not to alarm everyone, they're in the blood of about 99% of humans.
Wow.
And because of the reach of these chemicals, they're in a lot of things, and that means they're in pretty much every single landfill. So, you know, increasingly, as I cover this, I'm seeing a lot of the companies really freak out. It's come up on earnings calls. It's coming up at all of their meetings. You know, and I think there's two ways to approach it. One is there's concern that they could be held liable, you know, and that people will say, oh, this is a huge source of this, especially with, you know, PFAS gets into the leachate, gets into the air, and then there's a chance, you know, leachate goes to a wastewater treatment plant, and then it's treated, and then it's discharged.
Mm-hmm.
And then because the PFAS, they're called forever chemicals because they don't break down, so then it's in your water.
Right.
So there's definitely concerns, you know, that they might be held financially responsible, and they don't want that
mm-hmm.
for obvious reasons. But, you know, I think the counterpoint to that is, what's better at holding something that the public doesn't want than a landfill? You know,
right.
You can just, you know, take this and it's all over the place and collect it in this one spot, and, you know, they'd be able to monitor it. So you'll probably see a lot more about PFAS contamination, and understandably, there's going to be more conversations about community proximity to landfills because of that, I would imagine.
And so these are chemicals that are created when, like, like what are their man-made chemicals?
They're man-made chemicals, yes. So they were originally created, companies like 3M, DuPont, Chemours. Basically, they're non-stick chemicals. So anyone who owns anything with Teflon, this is probably the moment you throw it out. I've been there. But your non-stick pans, they're in so many things. They're in, like, floss. They're in rain jackets.
Floss, like dental floss?
Yeah, they're in the linings of microwavable popcorn bags. Sorry to be the bearer of bad news, but they're in many things.
Wow. Okay, so it's like a was sort of like a not a miracle, but like chemical or like,
too good to be true.
Yeah.
Chemical, yeah.
Like a yes category of chemicals that went into everything, and now we're realizing it's a really big problem.
And great. Now it's in everything, including you and me.
Yeah. I'm like, I wonder who the 1% of people are who it's not, you know.
If I recall correctly, they tested the blood of, like, war veterans before they had gone off to war, and that was, like, the testing. But it was, like, some very ridiculous.
Okay, it's so like 100%
blood sample.
Yeah, so 100% of people. Okay, great. All right, so in an effort to all the, obviously, you know, companies are, and we're going to talk about this a little bit more with packaging later on in the episode, but all of these companies are looking to, the private sector in general, looking to become more sustainable in a lot of ways. Very hot topic these days, which is good. But obviously, I think there's a lot of greenwashing happening. And one of the things I've seen come up more and more recently are these claims that companies are making that they are, quote, zero waste. What does that mean?
Yeah, zero waste is a misnomer that you'll see a lot. And understandably, everyone thinks that means zero. It doesn't mean zero. You know, typically, I've seen a number of percentages put to zero waste. 80 to 90% is typically about as close as you're going to get. I have a lot of reasons for that, but you know, when you generally see a company saying, you know, we've set a zero waste goal, usually they're thinking like 75% and higher.
Okay. And so that just means, what does that actually look like in practice? That they recycle everything or they, yeah, what does that mean?
Yeah. So again, it depends.
I think that's a big theme, right, for this episode with waste management. No, like, systematic approach to this industry, and it is no, like, regulation at the federal level. Seems to be the big takeaway. Yeah. Okay. All right, so this depends. Sorry to cut you off.
No consistency. Yeah, no. There's no consistency. I think how you're defining zero waste, what goes into your particular waste stream, you know, for a lot of, I think an easy place to start is everyone's like, oh, you know, we're going to try and eliminate, like, our food waste, you know, cut that out. I think with packaging, you know, you could strive for as much recyclability as possible. You know, there are various ways you can target it. Part of it is just, you know, the bigger the company, the bigger your supply chain and everything that goes into it. And at a certain point, it's like, I don't know, like a good exercise is just in your own life. Think about how much packaging and like how much waste comes into your home, how much is exiting it. And I mean, you know, as someone who's done an inventory on like my own usage, like, you're talking like the cling wrap that like surrounds your cheese, you know, the jugs, like everything that comes in, and you know, not all that's gonna be recyclable. And at that point, it's like, well, it's a waste item.
Yeah. Okay. All right. So, great segue into talking more about like the recycling issue. But before we do, we are going to take a really quick break to hear a word from our sponsors. So stay tuned.
This episode is brought to you by Sake Man. What is Sake Man? Sake Man are judo athletes wearing Lucha Libre-inspired masks that act as sake heroes. This team of athletes moonlight as sake educational professionals spreading sake to the world. Learn more about their mission and their favorite sakes at saketotheworld.com. That's saketotheworld.com.
And we're back on Eating Matters, where today I'm speaking with Ev Crunden from Waste Dive about the current state of the waste management and recycling industries and the challenges they face. Same question as for the waste management. Who are the kind of big stakeholders in this industry? You mentioned there's a lot of time overlap with the kind of like holy trinity of waste management companies.
Yeah, no, I mean, it's, again, it's mostly the same companies. Again, our favorites, Waste Management, Republic, Waste Connections, those guys, mm-hmm. if you remember them. You know, and you'll see a few companies that are maybe more focused on recycling specifically. Or, you know, you have municipalities play, I think, increasingly a bigger and bigger role in recycling. But for the most part, you're looking at pretty similar players and stakeholders.
And what are the current recycling rates overall? And, you know, if, I don't know if you have this breakdown by, like, type, like, material. But let me guess, like, zero. Not zero. That's not really. Like how many people recycle? Like, 5% of the population?
Good to start really low.
Yeah.
It's actually, I think overall we're closer to like 35%. These are guesstimates, but you know,
it's hard to tell.
Definitely. Like, yeah. But I think, you know, as far as recycling broadly goes, we're not doing great. There are certain products that are definitely more recycled. You know, cardboard is a big one. Much higher rates of cardboard recycling, paper recycling. You know, it gets much lower for things like plastics, mm-hmm. which is why you'll see so many conversations happening around plastics.
Are there any materials that are like absolutely not able to be recycled at this point?
You know, I'm reluctant to say, you know, you absolutely cannot recycle this. I think,
or very, very difficult.
Things, yeah, certain things are very challenging. I think, you know, big plastic wouldn't love this comment, but you know, well, there's a reason plastic bags get a lot of pushback from people, and that's that. So a recycling facility, which is, it's a materials recovery facility, or a MRF. Mm-hmm. You know, typically in a MRF, you know, a plastic bag is going to serve as a contaminant because it's going to mess with the machine. So you're unlikely to find a facility that's like, yeah, I really want your plastic bags.
Right.
So that's a hard one. You know, like cling, like film wrap is another one.
So these are single use.
Small.
These are single use plastic items.
Yeah. So those are the items where I would say it's very challenging. And, you know, their manufacturers would say you can recycle this. But logistically speaking, I don't know that you can recycle that.
But nobody does. So that's really interesting because I think that there's a, like, I think people just maybe don't think more, like, we have the tech, we can be recycling these types of packaging materials, but the industry just chooses not to.
You know, I think it's challenging. I think they would say, you know, a lack of education, you know, a lack of infrastructure, and, like, these are the reasons we don't do it. I think, you know, there are a lot of environmental groups that would say they love to use the example of like a bathtub that's overflowing because just plastics production is just ramping up and ramping up. There's more and more of it. And, you know, we just have like plugged the tub and all the water is coming out. So I think, you know, there's a lot in the supply chain. There's a lot of like virgin materials coming in. It's true that, you know, there's not a lot of education. The infrastructure isn't really there. And then the companies, I think, until very recently, were not very invested in solving that problem. So I saw reasons.
Right. What do you mean by the infrastructure? Like, what is lacking in what we, you know, from like a recycling perspective? Like, why don't we have this kind of infrastructure? Is it the facility? We don't have enough facilities. We don't have updated equipment. What are the big issues that are preventing like an expanded recycling capabilities?
Yeah, what I've always heard, you know, when I talk to people, you know, ask them what issues they're facing. You know, a lot of the MRFs, just like the infrastructure is just really outdated. So you're talking like, you know, machines and facilities really built in like the 90s, sometimes the 80s. Mm-hmm. So, you know, it's a much older, different time. Also, you know, you have to think plastics really only became a huge thing in, you know, a very recent time frame. And cardboard, similarly, you know, you have our friend Amazon has really, you know, pioneered sending everything cardboard. So more and more cardboard, more and more plastic, less and less glass. So a lot of the things that were, you know, all around when these MRFs were being built no longer, you know, comprise the bulk of the waste stream and the recycling stream. So that's part of it. Technology is another one. You know, there's just like not enough tech in these things, you know, and there's a very high, relative to other industries, a very high mortality rate for both waste and recycling. And, you know, some of that has to do with, you know, guys on the truck.
Wow.
And yeah. Issues with that. But then, you know, within MRF, you know, there's a lot of safety issues. So you just have, you know, these very old, outdated facilities and just not enough in them to really meet modern demand or modern labor standards.
Wow. This is a little bit kind of jumping back. You've written a little bit about number 3 sevens. What are those and what's the big controversy? I feel like it's a really big topic that I just asked you about and like a quick aside.
Yeah, the 3 through 7s. Yeah, so plastics, typically if you ever, this is a fun exercise for people. If you have a plastic, you know, I flip it over and you look at all three arrows, and sometimes they'll be really tiny. But if you squint and your eyes are good, you can see the number that's in, like,
if you look
the middle,
really hard.
The three arrows. Yeah, okay. They look really hard. Sometimes it's big, but it's frequently small. And you'll see like a 1, a 2, a 3, whatever. And probably if you have like a plastic bottle, you're going to see like a 1 or a 2. Those are much more recyclable.
So it's a type of plastic. It's a type of plastic.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. Type of plastic. They all have fun, long, complicated names. But typically when we think about 3 through 7s, we're talking plastics that, you know, are less recycled in the U.S. They're harder to recycle. I've seen a lot of programs, curbside programs, take them out and say, you know, we won't take these anymore. Mm-hmm. And they're the ones that have less of a domestic market. So they're very reliant on foreign end markets.
What does this typically look like? Are they like washing machine detergent bottles or like what constitutes a typical... What did you say? Three sevens.
Three sevens. It's a pretty big range, and you'll realize the full extent of just like how much everything is made from plastic if
right.
you start looking for them.
Yeah.
But you know, like a plastic chair is like an example. You know, things like the lovely, you know, food service containers, like the expanded polystyrene, or what you think of as styrofoam, that's, you know, mixed in there. You know, I think it's like a lot of types of plastic where you never thought, I wonder what number plastic this is.
Right.
But a good way of thinking about it is the plastic bottles and, like, you know, typically, like, you know, some like laundry detergent, you know, plastic containers, those are going to be more recyclable. Sometimes milk jugs.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas, you know, a lot of like a yogurt container, for example, very hard to recycle.
Really? Why?
Yep, just type of plastic.
Huh. Okay. I didn't realize there's a big difference between those two types of plastic. Like to the consumer, I feel like without, you know, the information on the bottle or on the package, which I actually find an astounding lack of labeling of like what is and isn't recyclable, and maybe it's there, maybe it's just so tiny and like I don't have really good eyesight so I miss it, but to me I'm like I don't see a big difference between those types of plastics, so it's okay, but there is. All right, I believe you. Okay, so what is the recycling process kind of like supposed to look like? It's supposed to be source separated by, let's say, the consumer and like a commercial businesses also. Then it's picked up by these haulers and brought to a like a processing facility. And are these typically
a MRF, right?
Okay, and then what happens there?
Yeah, so you know, typically, and then here's we'll get into some terminology. So you've got single stream and dual stream.
Mm-hmm.
Single stream is, you know, increasingly what you're seeing more and more of, which is if, say, you know, you live in D.C., you have, like, you know, your cart outside, and you just dump all your recyclables kind of in together. Dual stream tends to divide them out a little bit more. Might have, like, paper in one, plastics in another.
Yeah.
But increasingly, you know, to just deal with American consumers who really like convenience, we're really migrating nationally to single stream. So you have all of your recyclables, you know, they go to the MRF, and typically, you know, you sort them out. MRF jams are very common, which is when, you know, some some well-meaning human, you know, put all their stuff into a plastic bag and then they put it into the recycling bin. It comes to the MRF. It jams everything. Business stops. So they like fish out your plastic bag. That's pretty commonplace. And then, you know, typically whatever contaminants are in the waste stream are going to get sorted out. Those are going to get sent over to your nearest landfill or wherever.
What's a contaminant? What's an example of a contaminant?
Pretty diverse. You know, a lot of people love to immediately think of pizza boxes, so like giant grease stain, and that is correct. You know, anything that, like, paper is one of those, and, like, fiber generally, that can only be recycled a certain number of times. You're talking, like, 10 times max. And, you know, you get, like, I don't know, you, like, pour milk on paper or something. That's an obvious contaminant. But then some things I think people think less often about, you know, if your glass, you know, you try to recycle your glass shattered, it got stuck in the cardboard, now you have a mess. So that's another example of a contaminant. But the second it's contaminated, recycling potential really dwindling, and at that point, it's probably going to a landfill. So that can be depressing.
Okay. I also, like, didn't realize that a little bit of a grease stain on a pizza box could render it entirely unrecyclable.
Yeah. You can cut them out, though. You can, take scissors to your stands, and then the rest of it can be recycled.
Yeah, or, like, a little coffee stain on a piece of paper. Like, I really did not picture that as a contaminant. So, okay. Oops. on my end.
The more you know.
Yeah, the more you know. Okay, so then... Oh, also, can I just say, like, we have a dual stream, all right? Like, we separate plastic from cardboard, and then we wrap the cardboard in a plastic bag. So riddle me that. I mean, like, I never, like, ground. I'm like, why am I doing this? It's different, definitely mixing plastic and cardboard. What is the reason? Do you happen to know the rationale behind that other than just,
know the rationale behind that, minus that, you know, probably they're trying to insulate the cardboard and protect it because they can be easily contaminated. But it's always like, you know, you introduce anything else you introduce, then becomes another player in the waste stream. Yeah. So, you know, these systems, they just get more and more complicated.
Which, like, is not recyclable. I'm imagining a recycling bag is not recyclable, is it? Like a clear recycling bag? That's very thin plastic.
Probably not recyclable, no.
Oh, my God. All right. Well, I'm super depressed. But okay. So you talked about kind of contamination in the waste stream. Before I jump ahead to other issues. So it goes into the facility and then it's like broken down to the raw materials and then sent back to the manufacturer. Is that like a super rudimentary way of describing the process, or what am I missing?
Yeah. So typically, you're sorting it all out for sale, and that can be a number of places, domestically, internationally, what have you. You know, sometimes, you know, for certain materials, like glass is one where the market has suffered a bit, and now they're trying to kind of jumpstart it a little bit. And, you know, certain glass manufacturers will take the glass. You know, plastics, again, bit of a challenge. Increasingly, beverage manufacturers are trying to get their plastics back. So sometimes, you know, there are those systems in place. But it really depends. You know, your recycling is going to a lot of different places.
So these beverage manufacturers are theoretically trying to get it back to their own facility so they can process it themselves?
Yeah. So, and then this goes down an entirely another path. But, you know, you have some of the big guys, Coca-Cola, PepsiCo, Keurig Dr. Pepper, they have these big commitments they've made essentially to meet recycled content minimums. Mm-hmm. And, you know, we can get into this later if you want, but, you know, there is a real lack of recycled plastic in this country.
Right.
So increasingly they're trying to work with different players to get those bottles back specifically.
So they can handle it, they can process it themselves.
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. So let's talk about that actually. Like, there's been, I think, a number of reports that have come out recently that have said that recycling is not actually, you know, you throw it out, but then who knows where it goes. It might go to a recycling facility, but a lot of times it might not. It just is carted away to a landfill. Is that accurate? Is that really happening?
I always think it's good to, like, approach things with nuance. I think, you know, I think it is true that recycling in this country has definitely hit a bunch of hurdles. I think it has always had a lot of problems, and I think maybe people were less aware of them before now. It's definitely true that, you know, sometimes your recycling does go to a landfill. I think it's more likely than, you know, just like foul play or someone, you know, just dumping your recyclables into like your garbage or whatever. It's more likely that, you know, you didn't know what you should have been recycling, and in perfectly good faith, you know, we're trying to recycle an item and, you know, it didn't work at your MRF and now it's a contaminant. I think, you know, if I was, you know, going to advise someone on how best to approach it, a lot of it is just learning, you know, how your system works and what they take. And I think increasingly, you know, the sad part is you're going to learn what they don't take. And at that point, you're going to realize, like, just how many gaps there are in recycling at the municipal level. So, yeah, that's definitely true. I think it's definitely a less rosy picture than a lot of people like to believe.
Well, actually, I want to put a pin in that for a second. But you said, you know, what we talked a little bit about what recycling companies can and can't take. So can we play like a really fun game? And do you have like the top few items that you think, in your experience in reporting, you've seen are the most commonly misunderstood or, you know, thought to be recyclable but actually aren't?
I think the bags actually are a big one.
Yeah, that's true. Yeah,
like I've met a lot of people who really, really think that the bags are recyclable.
Yeah.
And I think honestly, just typically plastics, I think people really like overthink because they see the three arrows and they think, oh yeah, you know, this is recyclable, and like in theory, sure.
Yeah.
But in terms of like whether or not like your curbside program might not take 337s, and you might be dutifully sticking every 337 in there. And I think those are the ones that I typically see people, you know, overselling in terms of their recyclability.
Mm-hmm.
A sad one is glass, because glass is actually infinitely recyclable. And it, you are right that it should be. But increasingly, you know, I've seen, even like in the DMV area, Northern Virginia has like really run into some glass issues, and just, you know, the market for it is shakier and shakier. So it's entirely possible that you're trying to recycle your glass and it's not recyclable where you are.
So that just means
that's a pretty sad one.
The MRFs are just saying, we don't want it. We can't deal
with
this.
Yeah, they're just saying, yeah, we can't take it. And then it gets sent over to the landfill.
Wow. Okay. Well, that's a serious bummer. I feel like the coffee cups, there's a lot of, why aren't like to-go coffee cups recyclable? Or are they?
Yeah, so Big Fiber would not enjoy my comments on this topic. typically, they are not typically, and the reason I'm saying they are not is that you're usually looking at like a fiber plastic blend.
Mm-hmm.
And so because that's like your typical, I don't know, you go to Starbucks, say, a company very relevant in these conversations, and, you know, you order your coffee and it comes with that blend and then you throw it out. And so a lot of the fiber companies argue, oh, well, actually, it is recyclable if you just like did XYZ. But the actual feasibility of doing XYZ is pretty challenging.
What is XYZ?
You know, anytime you have a mix. Sorry.
I'll ask in a minute. You said anytime you have a mix of materials.
Yeah, anytime you have a mix of materials, it's very hard to recycle. And that even, you know, plastics a lot of times, you know, you start to mix types of plastics. And at that point, it's very challenging.
So what are you said, you know, you have to do like XYZ. So what's an example of like hoops you would have to jump through to recycle a coffee cup?
Yeah, I mean, really, to be able, like, if it's composed of, like, a plastic, you know, fiber combination, it would have to go through very specific treatment and go to very specific locations. And the likelihood of your municipality, your waste contractor, anyone being able to make that happen is just so infeasible that, you know, they're virtually non-recyclable.
So, and I think it's one of the big takeaways for me is that, like, which I also didn't realize, is that what you can recycle varies so drastic, or what you can recycle, what will be accepted for recycling, will drastically differ depending on where you live.
Oh, definitely. It's completely. And one municipality might have a completely different program than one right next to it.
Okay. Well, that's great. All right. So what are some of the other issues kind of facing the industry today? There's been a lot of capacity issues that we have mentioned, throughout this episode. Has this always been an issue facing the industry, or was there something that kind of triggered it?
I mean, in terms of recycling or in terms of landfills?
Recycling.
Yeah. So recycling, and this is, one of those sagas in that, there was a lot of buildup. It's true that Americans have never been very good at recycling or mm-hmm. at understanding, and then not necessarily, their own fault. Again, municipality to municipality. But just a long history of contamination, general lack of knowledge about the system. And for a very long time, we exported 337s, a lot of our contaminated recyclables, and they typically went to Asian markets. And then the crash of 2017-2018, when China implemented what everyone in the waste business calls a national sword, the official title. You'll hear them just talk about it flippantly. Mm-hmm. And that policy basically banned a bunch of the recyclables and then also implemented ridiculously low cutoffs for contamination to the extent that there was just no way that the U.S. was going to meet it. Mm-hmm. And so China basically had a hard stop and was like, we're not taking it anymore. And then a number of Southeast Asian countries similarly said, yeah, we're not going to take it anymore. And at that point, really, really deep ramifications for U.S. recycling because, all these contracts and these programs all just set up around the idea that no matter what, your recyclables are going somewhere. And they weren't going there anymore. So that's really, I don't know why you would do this, but if you ever happen to listen to an earnings call for a major waste company, you'll hear a lot of talks about, soft commodities markets, and just like the decline of foreign end markets and how they've really crumbled. And that's all about, this wider issue. And in light of that, increasingly municipalities started looking at their recycling programs and saying, we need to make cuts. There's definitely been some alarmism. I've seen people say 300 programs have been cut nationwide or as high as 3,000 programs have been cut. And my publication actually tracks those cuts. And we've come out closer to 70, which is significantly lower. Mm-hmm. But it's still notable. That's still significant. And I don't want to downplay that. Communities are definitely struggling. And a lot of it is like, communities have just suspended their curbside. A number have just cut different items, again, 337s, those popular little guys. Mm-hmm. So it's really just a lot of fallout and very much ongoing fallout that's still playing out now.
So these municipalities are just saying, we have to stop the picking up. We have to stop all recycling because we don't have the ability, we don't have an end market for it, meaning there's nowhere they could take it to, or they can't afford to do that, or what is the breakdown?
Yeah, essentially both. There's really, it would be so expensive to find, kind of a market for it. There's really no domestic markets for a lot of those items. And then, maybe you could, there are a few countries that will still take them, but just it's thinner and thinner. And a huge market like China is very different than, a smaller market, smaller country.
Right.
Okay. So just drying up increasingly, yeah.
So they have to pay an enormous amount of money to have this taken away, carted away. Got it.
Yeah.
Okay. So let's... I want to talk about federal or just kind of policy solutions and what that market looks like in a minute. But just real quick, I can't imagine that Germany, for instance, is facing some of these issues. So what are other countries? How are other countries making it work? And actually is my assumption that there are other countries that are, you know, much better at like waste management and recycling than we are. So if there are, what are they doing that we're not?
You know, I think, and I'm very U.S. Focused in my coverage, but I think it ranges in other places. Europe has a lot of incineration, which is a very controversial topic.
Okay.
And, you know, they also have much higher recycling rates.
Right.
So, you know, across the EU specifically, you'll see higher rates. Germany is a country that I believe has pretty high incineration rates, if I recall correctly.
Mm-hmm.
And I think, you know, some of the other, like maybe Scandinavian countries, kind of a similar deal. So, you know, that's part of it. Part of it also is just, frankly, U.S. consumers generate a lot of waste. And we're pretty unique in the amount of waste that we generate. Just, you know, convenience culture, Amazon, we love to go, all of those things. So it's kind of hard to make those comparisons. But, you know, I think you look at, like, a lot of countries that have really become the dumping ground for Western countries. And, you know, they're dealing with a much different situation where it's like they have all of their own waste and then they have everyone else's waste.
Right.
So different ends of the spectrum. And I don't think anyone's really come up with a silver bullet.
Yeah. Okay, so let's talk about some policy solutions. There's been a lot of movement on this front lately. Well, first of all, just to be totally clear, there is no federal regulation or legislation currently in existence that would govern, like, broadly these municipalities and make certain mandates. Is that correct?
Yeah, it's mostly, I mean, you know, there's like policies here and there, but for the most part, you know, federal government stances, this is up to the municipalities.
Okay. And not even the state, the states, it's like really kind of local city level.
Yeah, it gets kicked down in different ways. You know, states have some controls, obviously, but really it's a very granular, very local level set of processes.
Okay. But recently there have been a lot of kind of bills proposed at the federal level that have gotten a lot of attention. Can you tell us about a couple of these, the big ones?
Yeah. If you're someone who's following recycling policy, big time for you. but there's actually been a pretty notable influx of bills, and we're similarly tracking those. And it's interesting to see the trends play out. You know, there are some very notable industry-backed bills, and you can kind of get a sense of what industry wants by looking at the bills that they support.
Mm-hmm.
And it's a mix. So a very popular one with industry and with everyone, actually, environmental groups very much included, is the Recycle Act. And that is really education focused. It's in the Senate, I believe. And that one would really pump money and grants into just making sure people learn like what they can recycle. You know, outreach, teaching people, creating, you know, kind of some uniform things across the government, you know, making like maybe universal symbols that everyone can recognize, things like that. That's a pretty popular one. You have the Recover Act, which I believe is in the House, and that's one that's more infrastructure focused. So we talked a bit about infrastructure, the MRFs need help, what mm-hmm. have you. Obviously, a lot of industry players really like that. Some have pushed back on that, which I found interesting. You know, they argue that while we want education before, we want infrastructure, because if you upgrade our infrastructure first and no one's been educated, well, then we're just going to waste it all.
Yeah.
So I've actually interviewed a few people in the industry who have said, actually, no, we need the education money first and then help our infrastructure.
Okay.
And then, you know, you have kind of these in-between bills, and this one has a fun name, Save Our Seas 2.0, because 1.0 already passed, Trump administration signed it.
Oh.
2.0 is, you know, kind of the second coming, quite literally, and that one has already passed the Senate. And that's an interesting one. It's focused very much on plastic pollution, marine debris, and you see a lot of industry support. You might be wondering why plastics companies support it. Environmental groups are wondering the same thing, and that's why they don't really support it.
They're like, there's got to be something we're missing here.
There's some questions. The main criticism I've heard is it's very end of cycle focused. It's very, how do we fish plastic out of the ocean? And finding solutions for plastic that's out there.
Yeah.
A lot of groups. And I don't want to say there are definitely some environmental groups that do support that bill, but there are a number that basically say, oh, the real issue is beginning of cycle and really, really targeting the supply chain, which leads us to the very fun and controversial Break Free from Plastic Pollution Act, which was introduced, I believe, in both House and Senate. And that guy is a big one. And it really has it all. If you're industry, you call it the kitchen sink approach, which is, throw everything you've got. I don't think its chances of passing are particularly high right now. But would ban a number of things, targets things like the bags, expanded polystyrene, that styrofoam we were talking about.
Just outright ban them?
Yeah. I mean, there are caveats for some things. I think it's straws are banned, but could be provided upon request for disability issues. So some controversial things like that. There'd be a national bottle bill. So basically a national container deposit system. Mm. Their extended producer responsibility, EPR, which is, this idea that the manufacturers really need to take ownership of their products.
Right.
So that's written into that. So basically, you're required to get your bottles back, as opposed to, you yourself, take it upon yourself to get your bottles back. So that's a lot of components like that. Recycled content minimums. It really has it all. It's quite the bill. It's going to be interesting to see how that one plays out. And then the other one is it's kind of been sitting there for a while now, actually, which is the Zero Waste Act. Which Ilhan Omar from Minnesota introduced.
Yeah.
And she billed it at the time as key part of the Green New Deal. So watch this space, because it could come back to be an interesting one.
Yeah.
But similarly, kind of deals with source reduction, but also with infrastructure. It has a few different components.
Okay.
Altogether, it's a very, very diverse range of approaches to tackling these problems, and I think really represents how many different stakeholders and interests are involved in this conversation.
Yeah. It's an issue that seems like it needs to be tackled from a variety of different angles in order to really move the needle. So that's good, a positive thing, I would say. Are there anyone's emerging that, it seems like, for instance, the Break Free from Plastic bill, like you talked about, not, I don't want to say dead in the water, but probably not going to go very far, especially in this current deregulation friendly environment that we're in?
Yeah, I think, I've talked to people on all ends of the spectrum. I think general consensus is if any of them have a chance, it's going to be Save Our Seas 2.0, the fun named one. I've even heard them say they're going to work on a Save Our Seas 3.0, so stay tuned. That one, so much of getting your bill passed is buy-in in House and Senate. Anything with bipartisan support, way better shot. It is a very deregulatory political climate. There are some things that kind of seem DOA right now. I would say Zero Waste Act, Break Free from Plastic Pollution Act. I'm not giving them great odds right now,
right.
With the caveat that, by the end of this year, things could change dramatically.
Right.
So, it's interesting to talk to industry and talk to these companies, because while it's clear, you know, what they would prefer and then what might work best for them, it's also very clear that they seem to know that, you know, the wind could turn at any minute. So what stands a strong chance right now might not later, and vice versa.
And what has industry response been to kind of some of these, some of these issues that have cropped up, but also like the response from like elected officials? Are they trying to fight this, or are they a little bit more like amenable to the idea of being more regulated?
I think, you know, industry is at kind of an impasse in that they've really, I think they're open to, you know, admitting that a lack of regulation has hurt in some ways. You know, having everything vary from, you know, city to city, county to county, has not really helped the industry at all. It's really caused a lot of problems. However, I think, you know, it's kind of the golden rule that industry does not want to be regulated.
Yep.
So, you know, I think it's interesting to talk to them, a lot of these companies, because, you know, they really do need help. And I think increasingly they're saying they need help, but they're also really averse to too much help. And also they really want to shape what that help looks like.
Yeah. Yeah. That, is not surprising. Okay. So we have to wrap up in just 1 minute, but I want to ask, for our listeners, what can, you know, we do sort of on an individual level to help address some of these issues, like specifically with regard to recycling, beyond kind of educating ourselves? How can, like, you know, an individual help encourage and like prop up the market, I guess?
I mean, that's always, you know, kind of the golden question. I think, you know, obviously the more you understand, like, whatever your particular recycling system is, you know, the better empowered you are to, like, do it responsibly and then, you know, share that information with others. I think, you know, something that really stuck with me when I first started covering this beat, and I came in thinking I knew something about waste, and that was folly. but, you know, and I think that's true for all of us, but I think, you know, when you think of, like, three arrows and you think of recycling, I don't think I realized to what extent it's important to purchase products, you know, made with recycled material, and then to ensure, you know, just as you buy something made with recycled material, doesn't mean that it can, again, be recycled. So really making sure that you kind of choose your purchases and the things that you acquire with the understanding both, you know, that it came from something else and that it, like, could, again, go towards being something else. And just, you know, continuing that cycle, you know, and that can look like a number of things. But I think the more that you really just, like, stay aware of what you are, like, bringing into your life and also of, like, what its end use is and what it's going to be afterwards, I think that's really, like, the best thing you can do, which is, you know, such a long-term thing that you've built over time. But I actually think that's probably the most important part of any, you know, personal recycling practice.
Yeah, behavior change. And where can we get this information, like, from our local sanitation departments in terms of, like, what they are currently accepting and not accepting?
Yeah. So, it's my favorite answer. It depends. but I think you can usually access, you know, your city or your county, or, you know, maybe you're in a rural area. You can typically, you know, get in touch, with any officials, or hopefully they've got it on the website. If you're lucky, they have it on the website. And then you'll see kind of how your city interacts with it. I know, for example, if you're a D.C. resident and you're in a multifamily housing unit, I believe of more than four or more, at that point, you know, your building is in charge for, you know, the contracts and everything. So that might be a matter of, you know, talking to your building. New York, similarly, complicated system. You know, so you might have to figure out little nuances like that. And then once you figure that out, and once you know, whether it's one of these guys like Republic or Waste Management, or maybe it's a smaller local hauler, you know, once you figured out, who you're dealing with, at that point you can really get an idea of, you know, what's allowed and what's not.
Okay, last question. Where can our listeners go to learn more of these issues and track, you know, some of the ongoing like legislative proposals? That's one thing. And then personally, if people wanted to follow your work personally, where can they find it?
Well, I write for Waste Dive, so it's just wastedive.com, and we're currently tracking many elements of this, you know, the bills that are coming in. We have a tracker going for recycling legislation in Congress. Mm-hmm. We're tracking the curbside cancellations, and you can actually, we're doing it for all 50 states, so you can go and you can look up your state and you can see how National Sword and all that fallout has impacted where you live, mm-hmm. which can be nice. And then more broadly, you know, I think you can follow a lot of this on just the state and local level. Honestly, by going to your government website, COG meetings are pretty good spots to learn about recycling and waste issues. So, you know, if you're suddenly flush with free time, which I'm sure everyone is in our calm world, you know, that's an interesting way to learn more on a municipal level, just because really, I mean, it's very localized and then probably is very specific to where you live.
Right. Is that called community boards?
Yeah. So like Council of Governments.
Okay. All right. Great. So many great acronyms that I have learned. Yes. Today. All right. Well, we're going to have to leave it there. But Ev, I want to thank you so much for coming on the show. I really enjoyed learning more about these issues.
Yeah. Thank you so much for having me.
Okay. I also want to give a big thanks to our sponsors. Our show engineer is Jeet Paul, and show music is by Tim Archer. All episodes of Eating Matters are available on the HRN website or as a podcast wherever you find them. If you haven't done so already, please subscribe, leave me a comment, let me know what you think. I'm Jenna Liute, and thank you for listening.
Eating Matters is powered by Simplecast. Thanks for listening to Heritage Radio Network, food radio supported by you. For our freshest content and to learn more about our 10-year anniversary celebration happening all year long, subscribe to our newsletter. Enter your email at the bottom of our website, heritageradionetwork.org. Connect with us on Instagram and Twitter at @heritage_radio. You can also find us at facebook.com/heritageradionetwork. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization driving conversations to make the world a better, fairer, more delicious place. And we couldn't do it without support from listeners like you. Want to be a part of the food world's most innovative community? Subscribe to the shows you like, tell your friends, and please join the HRN family by becoming a member. Just click on the beating heart at the top right-hand side of our homepage. Thanks for listening.
I want to tell you about a new podcast called Amuse News. Publishing multiple days a week, Amuse News is your source for food news, interviews from around the food world, and more. On the show, we'll be engaging with food storytellers, from chefs to advocates to people working in the field, and many more. Find Amuse News wherever you get your podcasts. Amuse News is a destination for everyone who's looking for a new, insightful look into the world of food.